Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions, and Greg, later in the show, we're going to have some fun fleshing out an idea you had. Great albums by great bands that only gave us one album and then disappeared forever into the ether. One and done is what we're calling it. But first, we have some big music news. You've been all over it for the Chicago Tribune. Coming out of South by Southwest, we're going down to Texas next week. We always look forward to it. We see hundreds of bands, literally, come back and share the results of our expedition with our listeners over the course of the year to come. But there's a controversy that's been brewing even before the festival starts this year.
True, Jim. With a story that has national and international implications, a quarter of the bands that play at South by Southwest, there are about 2,200 bands play there every year, come from overseas, from 67 countries last year. So what we are seeing is a controversy about the language in its performance agreement with these bands that states that if the band acts in ways that adversely affect the viability of the artist's official South by Southwest showcase, the South by Southwest Conference will notify the appropriate U.S. immigration authorities of these violations.
Wow.
Now, this language has been in the contract for a number of years, but in light of the recent extreme vetting that is being imposed by the Trump administration against immigrants in this country, this contract clause has taken on renewed interest in the artist community. And several artists raised their hand and said, wait a minute, I'm not going to play this festival under the imposition of this contract language.
But you may rat out a foreign visitor to this country, a foreign artist, to the feds.
A lot of these artists come to South by Southwest and they play their one or two official South by Southwest shows. But in addition to that, they schedule one, two, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen additional gigs in order to help pay their way. Most of these bands can barely afford that trip. So any extra money that they can make to help pay their way is a good thing. South by Southwest was getting tired of these bands in competition with their official showcases and saying, hey, we can come down on you if we catch you playing these gigs.
Yeah, but the bands need it. I mean, you and I have seen bands from Tuva, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Throat Singers, you know? I mean, they traveled like in an airplane for 20 hours to get here. You want them to be able to play in front of as many people as possible.
Now, to their credit, South by Southwest came back a few days later and said, you know what, guys, we were wrong. We're going to revise this language. It doesn't look good for obvious reasons. They issued a statement in the last couple of days that said, with the announcement of President Trump's latest travel ban, South by Southwest would like to reaffirm its public opposition to these executive orders and provide ongoing support to the artists traveling from foreign countries to our event. They said that we will change the language in our artist invitation letter and performance agreement for 2018 and beyond, and they're going to remove the option of notifying immigration authorities in situations where a foreign artist might adversely affect the viability of their showcase.
Greg, obviously the political climate is going to weigh over all of South by Southwest. It'll be interesting to see how else it's felt. I know where I'm going to be Friday night. I don't often make plans in advance, but on the 17th, there is the Music of Band Nations showcase, and there are going to be artists performing from Iran, Somalia, Libya, Syria. I think that's fascinating. Taking place on St. Patrick's Day. Important to remember, once our Irish ancestors were vilified as immigrants. So, Greg, we're going to highlight what we've been calling some one-and-done artists now. This is an idea you had. What inspired this?
So, Jim, the idea was the last few months I'd come across a couple of records where I realized, hey, wait a minute, this is the only studio album that this artist ever officially released in their career. Why did we never hear from them again? I mean, we heard from them again, but they never made another studio album to follow up that first masterpiece. So it struck me as that there's got to be a few examples of this. Well, lo and behold, there's dozens of them, and you and I are going to highlight some of our favorites. I'm going to start us off with one of the most obvious ones in a way. Lauryn Hill has made only one solo studio album, and that was a monster. It came out in 1998, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Remember that she was the young rising star, a member of a great hip-hop group named the Fugees. which had considerable success in the 90s, went off and made a solo record at the age of 23. It was released when she was 23 years old in 1998. And it was a remarkable album, a coming-of-age album in which she addressed a number of serious topics, the breakup of the Fugees, her personal parting of ways with Wyclef Jean, her partner in the Fugees, the birth of her son Zion, who was name-checked in one of the song titles. Really a statement about what it means to be a woman of color, trying to forge your identity and independence in a world that often denies any of that to a person like that. You know, you see the template now in this record for what Beyoncé is now. I think Lauryn Hill could have had that kind of career had she continued to make music. And sporadically, we would hear from Lauryn Hill over the years. There was that sort of half-hearted live album that she put out, an acoustic record of songs in progress. It was never considered an official album. It was widely derided by critics as being a not fully formed effort. It certainly wasn't. She seemed to be in disarray. This was highlighted by the sad business that she had with the IRS. You know, she pleaded guilty to tax evasion in 2012, served a 3-month prison sentence in 2013. It's sort of been a sad public decline for Lauryn Hill in recent decades, despite the masterpiece that she created in 1998. Here's a track from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, a record that not only highlighted Lauryn Hill's talents, but the talents of her friends from that generation. Artists like D'Angelo and Mary J. Blige guested on this record, and a then unknown piano player by the name of John Stevens, a.k.a. the future John Legend. John Legend. This is his recorded debut on the song that I'm going to play. Everything is Everything from Lauryn Hill on Sound Opinions.
Practice extending across the atlas. I begat this, flipping in together on the dirty mattress. You can't match this, rapper slash actress. More powerful than two Cleopatras. Bomb graffiti on the tomb of Nefertiti. MCs ain't ready to take it to the Serengeti. My rhymes is heavy, like the mind of Sister Betty. El Boogie spars with stars and constellations. Then came down for a little conversation. Adjacent to the king, fear no human being. Roll with cherubims to Nassau Coliseum. Now hear this mixture with hip hop meets scripture. Develop a negative into a positive picture.
Now everything, everything is everything.
Everything is Everything from Lauryn Hill, a one-and-done classic, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Jim, what do you got up first?
I'm going to Germany, Greg. 1964, the year of my birth. Gelnhausen, Germany. You have five American GIs stationed there, On the downtime on the bass, they got nothing to do. So they form what is then called a beat group, right? Mm-hmm. Proto-garage, pre-Beatles, early, banging around rock and roll music. The band is called The Monks. The thing that's interesting about The Monks is it's hard to tell where that early garage primitivism, R&B played rather ineptly and loudly by guys who were all hopped up, on testosterone and speed, and where the avant-garde experimentation begins. Because there was a lot of playing around with guitar effects pedals, altered vocals, weird stuff. One of the guitarists played a six-string banjo that was treated primarily just as a noise generation machine, much like John Cale's viola in the Velvet Underground, but they were still several years down the road when the Monks got together and made their one and only album, Black Monk Time, 1966, March of 1966. It made no impact whatsoever upon its release, and it would be years and years later that garage archivists would discover them and crazy psychedelic champions like Julian Cope would laud them as geniuses, right? For this mixture of garage insanity and avant-garde experimentation. The other thing about the Monks is they were kind of scary. They dressed in monk robes. They took the whole costume thing so seriously that they shaved tonsures, the little bald patch on the back of their heads. And some of the Germans, who have a high tolerance for this sort of thing, thought they were blasphemous. Who are these Americans making this god-awful noise while dressed as monks? You'll see. There's melody and charm, but also weirdness and disturbingness in a track like this that I'm going to play from Black Monk Time. The song is called Boys Are Boys and Girls Are Choice. Boys Are Boys and Girls Are Choice by The Monks from album one and one only, Black Monk Time, 1966. Top that, Greg Codd.
I can't. I remember that when that was reissued like 20, 25 years ago, and it blew my mind. I go, where did this come from? And to find out that it was issued in 1966.
66.
We throw around terms like ahead of its time a lot, but that truly that really was.
Well, the other choice would have been for this slot for me, the Shags, which are a similar band. But Shags, get enough attention. The Monks don't.
Well, here's another band that a one-and-done band that I greatly lament never having heard from again with a new studio album. That's The Laws out of the UK. They formed in the 80s and signed to a major label deal off their demos. It took them 3 years and seven producers before their debut album, self-titled, came out in 1990. I remember talking to Lee Mavers, the singer, guitarist, and main songwriter in the group shortly thereafter, and he was bitterly disappointed by that experience, the fact that they could never quite capture the sound that he had in his head and on those demos on a recording. He said the demo should have come out. I don't understand why we had to get all these high-priced guys in the studio to muck up our sound, to put that filter between us and the music. Steve Lillywhite ended up getting the production credit on the record, and Steve Lillywhite's an incredibly accomplished producer, but Lee Mavers had nothing nice to say about any of the guys
he worked with. But the record sounds great.
It's a marvelous marvelous, marvelous record. And you get the perception that Lee Mavers is a little bit of a loose screw, a little bit of a weirdo, a little bit difficult to work with, but also a great songwriter. And he left behind one landmark album. There have been other attempts to get the Laws back together again over the years. None of those have resulted in a new studio album. The Laws from 1990, self-titled, and a great song called There She Goes on Sound Opinions. That is The Laws with There She Goes from their One and Done classic, The Laws, in 1990. After a break, more One and Done artists. Then later, we're going to review the new record from multi-genre bassist Thundercat. And Jim's going to put a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Take off your shoes and feel the grass.